You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the late morning of November 10th, 1905. A newspaper lay perfectly flat on a bare dirt spot, detailing Eugenio Sr.'s 1904 re-election landslide against a young, up-and-coming opponent who went into hiding after losing. Crazed by increasing senility, Ferdinand XIV was told by Ferdinand XV that the dogs Dave kept in total darkness were barking for something to maul. Neither father nor son were surprised that Eugenio got re-elected as easily as he did, calling bromelians foolish sheep who will blindly follow what appeals to their self-interests. Ferdinand XIV gave up trying to sway his former people years ago, believing that only force will make them obey and see the light. His bitterness over the Bromelian people turning on him after all the riches he provided them hadn't waned a bit, and described the last 58 months as the longest and most tense of his life. Ferdinand XIV admitted that his time in hiding made them realize that taking back the country can't happen overnight or with one move. This was why the plan he's been crafting was called Operation Ceres, and he found the Thanksgiving holiday on November 24th to be perfect for unleashing it, ordering Ferdinand XV to let Robbie Sr. and his gang out of their doghouse and hand them the order to head for Catalina Island. Ferdinand XIV told Eugenio that the era of him presiding over Bromelia unopposed was coming to an end, that'll start his climb back to power. Although Catalina Island still had its beaches and mountains, its forest was reduced to make way for development and the trails leading to and around them, creating the Garden of God in island form. At its near absolute center, the two-story home that housed the Regalados was now a magically gothic palace, only slightly smaller than the one in Versailles. In one of its dozens of regal suites, Habsburgo IV watched over his wife Pilar, who was breastfeeding Habsburgo V, proud of how his newborn son was his little him. His adopted son, Gabino Sr., joined Carlisle III, Grimsby Sr., and Josephine in helping Cura and her groom-to-be, Joseph Hasso, feed a pond's ducks. They're close enough to a portion of the island's east central coast to smell wet sand, hear ocean waves, and see seagulls fly. Deep in the northeast interior, Hambleton Sr. grew frustrated that Walpole was staring at the turkeys Dave cornered in a shed. He told her that whatever's prolonging her was going to deprive their clan of Thanksgiving supper, threatening to make her do it. That threat had Walpole clenching and shaking her gloved fists like a girl who'd cry over harming a fly, irking Hambleton into shooting away the turkeys' shanks and claws. In the palace's library, Eugenia and Eugenio Jr. read a book about one of the few potions Sajonia regretted making to whiskey and peanuts. Barclay helped Desiree scrutinize the fruits and vegetables harvested by the island's agriculturists for damage, earliness, and decay, smiling when the harvest ended up being satisfactory 9 out of every 10 times. Laverne led the troops guarding the island's east beaches, while the western ones were for Bird Jr. to lead the patrolling of. Her half of Eugenio Sr.'s personal police saw nothing hostile, but the one under his leadership noticed several fishing boats coming his way at a conjoined slow row. Burr's initial thought was that the boat rowers were fisher people who want to sell them their freshly caught fish, getting ready to tell them to go back. He was sure he'd told them that he and his clan will never buy a catch from them again for charging them a fortune for poisoned eels. The closer the fishers got, the more he doubted that they had come to sell him something, noticing the masks covering their faces, but not the menacing daggers directed at him and his coppers. Eugenio Sr. and Carlisle Jr. ambled along a trail in the island's west central interior as storm clouds dimmed the sky and finally rained. The men stayed dry by waiting for the precipitation to cease in the amphitheater, lighting candles and sharing a canteen of gin. Pressed to tell what's giving him bother, Carlisle asked Eugenio if he's ever thought of the possibility that someone will make an attempt on his life. His superior said that a man as venerated as he is finds that hard to be worried about, because never had he heard any man, woman, or child speak ill of him. Eugenio explained how nobody and nothing would dare oppose him, and those who foolishly do will die torturous deaths that'll be in vain. When the so-called fishers hit the shore, they threw down the paddles, opening fire with guns that had unprecedented firing power. Burr yelled that enemies were ashore, enraging his coppers into fighting back with a quantitative might thrice as fierce. Laverne ordered her fighters to help his when the attack began, but were caught off guard by a second fisher-disguised militia still rowing its way to the shore. Eugenia and Eugenio Jr. heard what sounded like thunder booming almost nonstop and invariably at or near the ground. This didn't concern them, as they've seen lightning flash strike across and shoot downward all morning, all while their inhibitions loosened from the whiskey they consumed at approximate 1 hour intervals. The experience the fisher-disguised militants acquired from a historically dark time made overwhelming Burr and Laverne's troops easy. Their enemies' retreat inland amused and reminded them of the revenges they vowed to exact, unmasking their three co-leaders as Robbie Sr., Laverne's older sister Camellia, and Catalino III. Although diverse in gender, age, and skin color, the militia's members were all alumni of Ferdinand XIV's quarantine imposition. Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino imagined being in the masking bodysuits that hid their identities and protected them from the plague. Their time as imposers was blessed by the duty of ridding Bromelia of a bug that could end the world as they knew it. The cost of that blessing was the curse of fearing that their identities may one day be uncovered for many to seek reprisal against. Each of them had enough people on their consciences to populate whole towns, imagining their worst fear of the communities they've scarred, publicly demeaning and mangling them to death. Minutes into the quarantine, Camellia was involved in shooting down 16 children at a park and piling their bodies like cattle, burning them and where they played. Only she and those in her unit knew of the killing as it happened at night and someplace isolated. Robbie took part in wiping out a demonstration against the quarantine in downtown Bromelia City, executing the detained, burning them as well as those killed earlier, and the city square where the protest occurred. What stuck out to him was how haughtily proud the protesters were to die fighting for their quote-unquote rights, feeling unable to stop his unit's leader from giving their arrestees the demises they desired. On the sunrise after the quarantine went into effect, Catalino helped massacre 6 families hiding from imposers in the woods, adults, children, and all. He prevented grief and remorse from compromising his will to patrol by telling himself that he didn't murder that person or those people, and that they're the ones who endangered his life when they selfishly violated the quarantine while possibly being carriers of the plague. Robbie harked back on how imposers like him were trained not to look at people who violated the quarantine as human beings. His trainer stooped to abusive lows to hit home their belief that if the violators were willing to imperil lives for brief leisure, then they'd have the willingness to scratch and bite the way a rabid mammal would. Robbie recalled his battle in Deneve, his hometown, but one he hated as much as its people despised him. During the first day of training, Camellia was punished for saying that she'd let the kids continue playing if they exhibited no symptoms of the plague. One trainer poked fun at her dependence on glasses and cherubic looks, while another abraded her skin with a whip and threatened to have others anguish in kind if they didn't wise up at once, indenting her soul with a scar that bled out her innocence and sensitivity to pain along with it. Catalino was never punished because of his conscious decision to agree with and do everything without question or restraint. That didn't spare him from having to watch other trainees be whipped raw, including people he knew and loved for years. But when the training concluded, Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino reported to the imposition with hearts as dark as night and minds more singular than the number one. The 3 had their militants charge out of the boats and up the beach, forming a thin yet firm perimeter that looked inland and back at the sea. Cura, Joseph, Gabino, Carlisle III, Grimsby, and Josephine were watching baby ducks follow the mothers when Laverne's troops galloped back to try assuming a defensive or drop dead from being shot. Walpole watched the turkeys yelp with only their main bodies still functioning, quivering as blood trickled from where Hambleton shot them. He implored her to end their misery, for their deaths were now inevitable, in that prolonging their expiries won't make their survivals any more likely. Walpole wanted to believe that the turkeys could somehow be saved, but Hambleton forced her to take his gun and finish them off at one stroke. Her desire not to kill was no match for his will to make her get over her fear of ending any kind of life, succeeding in what even Eugenio Sr. failed to do. Something in Walpole broke when Hambleton made her fire the fatal shots, but the severe shock she was in hid this, and how the impact it'll have on her will be one he'll grow to loathe. Their moment was interrupted by distant, continuous shooting, and an earth-shaking boom abruptly ended it, jolting them into running back to the palace. During that run, Walpole's face was cooled of its warm grief because of the warmth from Hambleton's tender hold on her hand, convincing her that his care for her was sincere and not merely rhetorical. Eugenia And Eugenio Jr.'s concern grew the longer the Thunder went on, seeming like it was advancing toward them ever so gradually. Then the boom Walpole and Hambleton heard jolted them into looking out a window where they saw smoke rise from the forest. Eugenia and Eugenio rushed up 6 stories to the rooftop and looked into the north and south binocular telescopes, seeing that the smoke was from a bomb. On a sudden, a second explosion knocked them off their feet, and when they looked toward where it came from, they saw splattered blood, flesh, dead guards, and those who were dying. Only now did Eugenia and Eugenio notice how the thunder rumbled its way up, and that it's been a while since a light streak or bright flash was last seen. Through the east and west telescopes, they saw Cura, Joseph, and Carlyle III rush inland and past Laverne's troops carrying Josephine, Grimsby, and Gabino. Hearing people rush toward her, Eugenia looked downward forthwith and saw a number of her former summer school peers take shelter in the palace. Eugenio wasn't distracted by this and kept his telescope focused on the duck pond, capturing the masked intruders who were killing Laverne's troops in large numbers. He turned toward the hexagonal fountain and saw Burr's defensive fall back more slowly but take heavier casualties. Eugenio slightly gasped at Eugenia grabbing a monopodded conch shell as heavy as her but at twice her height. He froze as she pressed her lips against the hole atop it and blew as hard as she could, blowing out a reverberant om that everyone on the island heard, raising Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino's hairs with its unmistakable echo. No one attacking, defending, or running didn't know what that sound meant, and its roots were set in Eugenio Sr.'s summer school 13 years ago. Anticipating an onslaught without equal, Robbie, Camellia, Catalino, and their troops opened fire at anything that wasn't them, surprising the guards that popped out of the ground, but only briefly. Their superior weaponry made them a match their opponents have yet to encounter, and thus both sides had exhausted their ammo by dusk. But few casualties and no further loss of life occurred on either the guard or militia side, resulting in a torturous standoff. Left with knives and empty rifles, Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino held their impulse to run into a throwing, stabbing, and whipping match to the death. The rising moon was their tell to hold their encircle and keep it whole until their backup came ashore, as Ferdinand XIV didn't expect the initial assault to bring Eugenio down. What put the invasion's success in doubt was that the guards that were in the ground were groomed to suffer to the death with absolute stoicness. And adding to that weight was the attack those reinforcements were carrying out in Catalina Coast, attempting to overthrow the municipal government to establish a foothold Ferdinand could use to entrap Eugenio and his people like rats and smother their remaining days in fire and brimstone. Eugenio decided to end the standoff with a surprise he had at the ready should his island ever be invaded, another cog in a machine tasked with crushing dissent against him. That end began when he ordered the guards at his palace to get the indigo cannonballs out of the basement armory and shove them into the surrounding cannons. Eugenio waited for his loved ones to be inside, and that included Burr and Laverne. Then they each consumed 1 teaspoon of a syrup that smelled and tasted putrid. Only seconds were needed for what was taken to take effect, immunizing them from the implosive quality mixed into the cannonballs. Eugenio wasted no time yelling out his order to fire at will, knowing that he and his loved ones won't be protected from the potion for long. Having read extensively about the indigo Sajonia accidentally created, he understood that even the most powerful immunizers can only quell its power temporarily. Eugenio called that fact true until today, for he has something that'll indefinitely protect him and his loved ones from the potion's implosive effect. But what that thing entailed was as painful as it looked, and he knew that only he would take it voluntarily. He thanked his scientists for all the work they've put into a project they gave up on and completed only because he ordered them to, under penalty of death by hanging. Eugenio smiled at the 67 lives he sacrificed in the name of immunity, believing that in heaven they're being hoisted as heroes. During the 1904 election season, he echoed that belief during a packed rally at the first incarnation of Bromelia's National Stadium. The cannonballs shot into the air like a shockwave, as if they sought to impact the trees near where the guards and militia stood toe-to-toe. Both sides had less than a second to crouch down, cover their ears, use their knives and rifles as shields, and brace themselves. The cannonballs simultaneously blew the trees they impacted in half, bursting out indigo flames and emitting smoke of the same color. Their impact knocked guards and militants off balance, them out or into their deaths, rendering Robbie, Camelia, Catalino, and their surviving militants defenseless against a power Eugenio's guards were numb to. The smoke that came out of the flames was vivid and all but solid, spreading out and up to where people from Catalina Coast could see it. But due to the situation there, very few noticed it, and so others couldn't be alerted because all attention was on not letting the rebels massacre them or their elected leaders. The insurrection partly, mostly, or utterly dismantled buildings, lit fires on every corner, and littered dead bodies everywhere. Not only weren't children and the elderly spared of its hard-hearted rampage, the rebels saw them as essential to their attack's next phase. Their sights pointed at City Hall, the Municipal Courthouse, Mayoral House, and Catalina Aragon Memorial, thinking of what their master said about the youngest and oldest when he was still president. Ferdinand commented that children were the easiest to corrupt and purify, whereas with the elderly, making such changes happen was a forlorn effort. He said while the young were worthy of patience, the old deserved only a choice between capitulation and death. Ferdinand instructed his militia and insurrectionists to keep as many children alive as possible and to kill the old and middle-aged as needed. Expecting a severe response to the insurgencies, he had militant groups who've long blended in with the people of West Bromel Beach, North Bromel Beach, East Bromel Beach, Desierto del Sureste, South Bromel Beach, Humedal, Costa Sur, and Central Bromel Lake, La Gran Lanuda. Ferdinand had his loved ones write copy after copy of his order to attack at will for his Prus Blue Robins to give to his waiting troops. The aim was to enrage Eugenio into sicking his government's full might on the insurgencies so that the quote-unquote five beaches and one lake will be left vulnerable to attack. Feeling unstoppable, Ferdinand noticed a robin flying right at him, looking ready to attack him with the oil-spotted paper it held. Before he could react, the bird was shot down by Ferdinand XV, saying that what he killed was poisoned by black potion from beak to feet. He yelled for Ferdinand XIV and his other loved ones to keep their distance, as even the slightest inhale of what that robin carried could kill. Ferdinand XV used two long sticks to unroll the paper, hold it in the air, and get it close enough for him to read a message that had death written all over it. The smoke's aroma reached the entirety of the island, even if it remained around where the cannonballs made their impacts. Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino retched like they'd never before and convulsively wailed as if their beings were melting away. Those in their militia reacted in like manner, but actually felt their minds implode, dull to cold gruel, see their memories and feel their identities be erased like chalk off a blackboard. Neither Robbie, Camellia, nor Catalino endured such implosions, and instead the smoke's odor stripped them of their bodily strengths. Eugenio's guards were unaffected, thanks to them being the first to test out their master's new concoction, protecting them from the potion's imploding effect and its crippling malodor. Once the imploding and stripping was done, the militants were taken into the palace and thrown onto its church floor. Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino were too weak to resist or express displeasure, while their fellow captured maintained looks that hovered from dull to fascinated and back. Guards surrounded them as Eugenio stood on the rooftop and watched fire and smoke smother Catalina Coast. He wrote a note that declared total war against the rebels, rolled it up to feed a robin, and had the bird take flight for Brumelia's capital building. Eugenio entered the church with his loved ones in tow, expressing how splendid it was to have so many would-be assassins within his reach. He'd praise his intruders for getting as far as they did, if that was how his brain functioned, saying that no effort will exonerate them of their traitorous act against the Brumelian people. Eugenio said that a lesser man would dispose of them where they knelt without delay, but not one as righteous as he. He assumed that the intruders were sent by Ferdinand XIV to vanquish him, as no one else in Brumelia could organize an effort that brazen. What Eugenio didn't know was who the three leaders were, and when he unmasked them, he was knocked for six to see Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino, former students of his summer school. Laverne never thought her big sister would take part in such an intruding, let alone be one of its leaders, and was unsure who she was looking at now. Not once did Carlyle Jr. think that an Aragona, much less a descendant of Catalina, would involve himself in such treason. Eugenio was particularly disappointed to see Robbie, the young man who challenged him in the 1904 election, and only opponent whose life was spared. His decision not to get rid of his former student was due to their time together in his summer school, believing that a bit of his persuasion will always exist in the pupils he groomed that pivotal semester. Eugenio's disappointment seethed when he saw the plus signs burnt on the left side of Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino's necks. Another one of his first actions as president was initiating a hunt for each person involved in enforcing the quarantine, imploring his people to divulge what they knew with regard to acts committed and those responsible. What Eugenio initiated was a persecution his loved ones did not agree with, but still voiced their support for in fear of being targeted. Habsburg IV, Burr, Walpole, and Hambleton knew what being persecuted by him felt like, and their attempt to escape during the summer school wasn't the last time they crossed him. Memories of that semester poked them with needles that weren't any less sharp now as they were then. Eugenio said the reading he's done since becoming president had reached a height that no other time could fathom equaling. He learned about where species originated from and what will allow humanity to survive and evolve, realizing that the Bromelian was a superhuman destined to be the creator, destroyer, and controller of the natural order. Eugenio yelled that he's a savior who makes wrongs right and cleanses people of all impurity. He said his summer school proved that even the worst delinquents can be made capable of governing a nation that'll soon be the Earth's most powerful. Eugenio wholeheartedly believed that no mean was too terrible to utilize if the end can justify it more strongly. But when Eugenio blew the conch shell, an epiphany touched his soul, showing him what must be done to rise above a cruel world. Carlyle wondered what he was talking about, as his presidency had gone virtually unchallenged until now. Thinking that the attack was an aberration he believed would come sooner or later. Eugenio said he's thankful to have ruled Bromelia with no significant opposition for over 4 years, transforming the country in his new Bromelian century image, but today woke him up to the end of that time of certainty and comfort, for now a threat to his rule and project had risen from the dead. And his name was Ferdinand. Eugenio asked what good will come out of executing Robbie, Camellia, Catalino, and their militants, besides the feeling that justice was served, telling them that they will serve him whether or not their desire to exist. He added that if they all coexist as one, their alliance will lead to survival and legacies being formed. Destinies he knew Ferdinand had no intention of giving to his subordinates, especially those who've failed or fallen. Eugenio was told all about the fraud his predecessor perpetrated on the world with the Ferdinandium, struggling not to retch at that word's very saying. He said that alone would have warranted a death sentence, but when coupled with a slaughter like the quarantine, the only demise Ferdinand deserved now was a slow and agonizing one. Saying that battered Eugenia, Eugenio Jr., Barclay and Cura, with all the times Eugenio Sr. pummeled them as Desiree either did nothing or helped. As far apart as Catalina Island and Catalina Coast were, there were instances where the summer school students could see the locals go about their day. Those sights brief and days in between, kids such as Robbie valued them like their most prized possessions. Moments like those made him and others feel normal and not like castaways, a light in a world where darkness was all that could be seen. Then, out of nowhere, a heavy gunshot echoed from out a rifle to the church's walls, causing a quiet, only hollow wind howls could break through. Eugenio demanded to know why everyone was looking at him in horror, then saw the blood near his feet and drips of it hit that same copious pool. He grabbed the back of his head and felt something very wet, widening his eyes with a fear his loved ones hadn't seen on his face for quite some time. Eugenio quickly forced his right hand in front of him and saw it soaked and dripping with blood, horrifying him into looking back where he saw Carlyle bitterly aim a rifle at him. That shot stunned the tears out of Eugenia, had Kira gasping, left Barclay speechless, and made Eugenio Jr. angrily grind his teeth. Carlyle told Eugenio Sr. that every single body in the church waited 13 years to hear that gunshot and see his face look like that. A note telling Ferdinand that the government knew where he was flapped to the wind as oily black stains made it difficult to read. Eugenio's military encircled the valley and village the Lobos and their closest loyalists called home and reduced it to ashy rubble. Eugenio snarled and charged at Carlyle in an attempt to strangle him, but collapsed to his death before he could lay a finger on him. His troops reached the village's grand cabin, spotted a rugged older man resting peacefully inside, and were about to shoot him away, but held their fire when they saw that he was dead. After looking at his face more closely, they were beside themselves when that person turned out to be Ferdinand. Eugenio's troops couldn't unlook how little he resembled the enterprising heir who governed Bromelia with a velvet glove that hardened to an iron fist. The black oil smearing Ferdinand's face and staining his tongue was indicative of a death he chose to inflict upon himself. Eugenio's troops were disappointed over being denied the pleasure of giving their mortal enemy the ultimate demise, screaming and exhausting their anger by breaking the rubble to pieces of wood no bigger than human fingers. It was only after all that destruction when they realized that Ferdinand was gone at last, and thus their nation can now move on. The troops smothered the body in kindling strands and tinder clouds like fish tucked in leaves, setting it on fire and watching the flames char it to a brittleness easy for the breeze to chip away at. Distraught by Ferdinand's decision, his family and loyalists fled Bromelia by hopping from one friendly settlement to another. Those hops continued until they reached a secluded part of Bromelia's southeast coast, and from there, boats picked them up, and before they knew it, they were sailing to Sochitilia, a salvation the Lobos had plans for, the ones that another couple had for Bromelia after fleeing their native Great Britain. Seeing Eugenio dead was a burden off Habsburgo, Burr, Walpole, and Hambleton's backs, and they couldn't thank Carlyle more for it. Yet, only half of the people in the church felt that relief, and as for the other, rage readied itself to erupt and burn all with its magma. But when Carlyle declared himself Bromelia's new president, that anger forced itself into a repression that applauded for now and lived to reprise sometime soon. After Eugenio was buried in an unmarked grave, his former loved ones received note after note about how the insurrection in Catalina Coast had been quelled and that those involved were awaiting their dates with the firing squad, and a speech was formulated out of the blue. Carlyle spent the boat ride to the mainland thinking about how easier the Catalina Island clique must be breathing now that Eugenio was gone. He had himself, his loved ones, and guards all swear to keep the shot he fired a secret, and that no Bromelian was to know the truth about how their president died. Carlyle threatened to make 100 deaths befall on anyone who says a word now or at any point in the near or distant future. In the burnt and devastated remains of Catalina Coast, he announced that Eugenio was one of the lives lost in the insurrection and that the traitors will soon be punished to an extent not seen in ages and for all to bear witness to. Carlyle was also pleased to inform the Bromelian people that they've found Ferdinand's hideaway and him deceased. Smiling at the loud ovation, he appointed Habsburgo as his vice president to Burr's grave dislike, welcoming his lead subordinate with open arms. Walpole and Hambleton were appreciative of the choice made, but Eugenio Jr. and Barclay weren't. Cura was especially livid to see Habsburgo be Carlyle's number two, vowing to take down their presidency and seeing Robbie, Camellia, and Catalino as valuable to that effort. With Playa del Paz, Xochitlia now in sight, Ferdinand XV knew what he had to do to avenge Ferdinand XIV and Ferdinand XIII, who succumbed to despair less than a year after learning that Eugenio Sr. had become president. His father's sacrifice and seeing his grandfather slowly fade out of his presence brought his mind a guilt that came from standing idly by as said elders destroyed themselves for the little glory they could grasp. Ferdinand XVI couldn't stop imagining the horror he felt when Ferdinand XIV licked the poisoned note and rubbed its oily stains on his skin. Gregorio Sr. teared up over how his grandfather lied down, stared at the sky, and waited for death to come with a peacefulness he hadn't seen shine out of him in years. Yet he and Ferdinand XVI were glad to imagine Ferdinand XIV and Ferdinand XIII happily together in a kingdom of eternal serenity. Carlyle was ashamed to tell his people that insurrections have also broken out in the Five Beaches and One Lake. He said the military was doing everything conceivable to rush to those six municipalities in time to prevent a broader conflict from ensuing. Carlyle called the insurrectionists who attacked Catalina Coast and were attacking the beaches and lake servants to an order that neglected, abused, and locked its own people in darkness. He was intent on carrying on Eugenio's effort to hunt down the people responsible for Ferdinand XIV's quarantine, although deep down, he planned to use that hunt to distract the Bromelian people from his real plans. And as fate would have it, what Carlyle had planned would collide with Cura's secret connivance as well as the fateful transformation the Lobos were planning to have Xochitlia undergo. And that was Ferdinand's In Circle. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.